It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we'll get some great recipes for bread making and find out what to do with all that delicious bread.
First, this weekend marks the 100th day of Donald Trump's presidency, one of the most symbolic days for a new administration. For most presidents, the early days in the Oval Office mark a honeymoon phase when there are high approval ratings and supporters are often excited about a candidate-turned-president's new initiatives.
But the 2016 election was different. Both Trump and his opponent, Hillary Clinton, had low approval ratings, and analysts did not expect either to have a honeymoon phase if elected. Right now, Donald Trump's approval rating is roughly 40%. That's much lower than President Bush and President Obama's approval ratings in their first 100 days, which were both over 60%.
Elizabeth Sherman is an assistant professor of American politics at American University's School of Public Affairs. She joins us now for a look at President Trump's first 100 days in office. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Let's look at those approval ratings after just shy now of 100 days. Why are they where they are?
Well, I think the main reason is because when President Trump came into office, as you said, he had low approval ratings in the beginning, but certainly both candidates had. But he hasn't really done much to improve his approval ratings, which is surprising. Since the inauguration, where he made a lot of very powerful promises, you know, he said that day that we're going to have great schools, safe neighborhoods, good jobs are going to be coming back, and we're going to share the wealth that hasn't been shared. And so, you know, it was an opportunity to reach out to the people who didn't support him on Inauguration Day. That's typically what presidents do. But he really didn't do that. He didn't say, you know, we are one country, let's all come together, or he didn't make any gestures following that. I mean, it seems as though he's really stuck with his base, as you said, about 40%, and they're staying with him, although I think it's worth remembering, Rob, that when you look at those polls of the 40%, half of them strongly approve of Donald Trump, and that's, you know, that's his hardcore base. But the other half only somewhat approve. And I think the people that have left and say, you know, they're not approving, they don't like the way he's been governing, a lot of them are the independents.
And let's talk about this 100-day milestone. It is a nice round number, but it is just a number. Is there some worth, though, 3 months-ish into a president's term to take stock of how things are going so far?
Well, I think it is a good time to do that because it's the American tradition. So, like it or not, every president has to face that 100-day mark. You know, Franklin Roosevelt kind of laid it down, and all the presidents since, for good or ill, have had to, you know, cope with it. I think, as you said, the politics for Donald Trump have been very, very difficult. He's faced, you know, a lot of difficulty. Certainly the Russia probe, there have been huge demonstrations. I think the Women's March was the biggest demonstration in history. So, you know, he's seen his opposition, but as I said, rhetorically and every other way, even on policy, he hasn't reached out. On public policy, I think there's a lot to be desired. He's certainly pivoted to tax reform in the last week. He's rolled out a big tax plan. The health care plan didn't go very far. They were counting on that because that would have meant a huge tax cut with the end of Obamacare of about $1 trillion, and they were hoping, you know, to use that money for this big, gigantic tax cut that they've just rolled out. That, you know, remains to be seen. I think this is a president who obviously has never been involved in politics and government, has always been, you know, in the real estate business, and I think he's learning the hard way. Again, as Roosevelt said, the president proposes, but the Congress disposes, and so far they have not been particularly willing to go along with some of his demands. And as you probably know, he did send his aides to Capitol Hill to make demands, to tell them, this is not a debate. You will vote the way we want you to. That didn't sit well.
Talking to Elizabeth Sherman from American University about President Trump's first 100 days in office. Elizabeth, the presidency, a job unlike any other. Anybody coming into this gig is going to have a learning curve. How do the early days of the Trump administration, both for the president and his team, stack up to some previous recent administrations?
Oh, I think, you know, much, much worse. Most presidents do try to reach out to the other side and bring the country together. And this is typically the honeymoon period when they get favorable press. But pretty much right out of the gate, we had all of these problems with his national security advisor. All these revelations almost from the beginning about the contacts between his aides and the Russians, and apparently there was a lot of evidence that that there was Russian meddling in the election, very much in favor of President Trump. Now, whether or not his campaign was involved with that, I don't know, but it's been an ongoing probe, and I think that's Representative Nunez said, this is a dark cloud over this administration, so that's been tough. I think on health care, it was a debacle from the beginning. It looked as though the Republicans were just not ready for prime time. Certainly the House of Representatives was not able to get united. And people were, I think, very stunned. It only takes a simple majority in the House to do anything, and they couldn't come together on a repeal and replace, with the replace being really hard. The thing about it is that Donald Trump said, I'm going to focus on the working men and women, the forgotten men and women, as he said. We're going to have good schools. We're going to end crime. We're going to bring all the jobs back. We're going to have infrastructure, as he said in his inauguration. We're going to have highways and tunnels and bridges and airports and railways. They're all going to be new, and this is going to be fantastic. We're going to rebuild our country. But what have we seen? The health care bill didn't go anywhere. And I think it's worth remembering, Rob, that Obamacare was really just designed for a pretty small proportion of the American people, about that 20% who didn't have insurance. I mean, we have 110 million who are, either on Medicare or Medicaid or some other regular government program. 55% of all Americans are covered by their employers. So it's just this one little group that need insurance. And, they haven't been able to figure out a way to provide insurance for them that's affordable. That's a tough project. It looks like they tried to push it too soon, too early. Now they have a giant tax cut that's going to benefit, the top 5% or so, and it's going to be a huge $4 trillion tax cut that they proposed, mostly that money will go to the corporations. So I think a lot of Americans are beginning to wonder, well, what happened to the big project to rebuild America? What about all the jobs coming back? They're trying to make the argument that tax cuts to the big corporations eventually will trickle down and reach the people who are struggling and the people who don't have jobs, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that's a very complicated argument. I think a lot of people are surprised.
I want to jump in and get to another signature issue for the president. One of the big applause lines really from the campaign trail, the wall on the border with Mexico. Here's a clip of him, President Trump, talking about plans for the wall in an interview shortly after the inauguration. This is with ABC's David Muir.
Are you going to direct U.S. funds to pay for this wall? Will American taxpayers pay for the wall?
Ultimately, it'll come out of what's happening with Mexico. We're going to be starting those negotiations relatively soon, and we will be in a form reimbursed by Mexico, which I've always said.
So they'll pay us back?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Yes.
So the American taxpayer will pay for the wall at first?
All it is we'll be reimbursed at a later date from whatever transaction we make from Mexico.
Now, the funding for the wall looks like is dropped from this continuing resolution to keep the government open.
Right.
Basically, this was an issue I imagine Donald Trump supporters were definitely looking for quick action on.
Of course they were. But on the other hand, I think even his supporters recognized that was going to be kind of hard to do. It was going to be symbolic, and you know, if it doesn't get built, I'm not so sure they're going to be so furious. Of course, you know, it symbolizes the promise that we're keeping those people out, and we're going to round them up. We're going to get tough on immigration, and I think his hardcore supporters have to be very delighted. I mean, it looks like ICE and the immigration authorities are picking people up if they are not illegal immigrants, and there's no path now to any kind of legality for them. You know, it looks like they're getting very, very tough on the deportation force that he promised. You know, whether he can push through that wall, I don't know. But again, Rob, very, very divisive. Very, very divisive issues he's pushing here. He continues to just exacerbate that divisiveness in the country. I think it's thrilling for those who are his supporters. But on the other hand, you know, it's unusual to see a president who, you know, just sort of maintains that antagonism right through his administration.
Talking to Elizabeth Sherman, assistant professor of American politics at American University. We're talking about President Trump's presidency so far, just ahead of his 100th day in office.
You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what you think of President Trump's performance in his first 100 days. If you voted for Donald Trump, are you pleased with the job that he's done so far? And what did you think of the executive orders that he signed? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up the conversation now with Elizabeth Sherman, assistant professor of American politics at American University's School of Public Affairs, talking about President Trump's 100 days in office. We hit that mark this weekend.
And we'd love to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234 or on the Central Time Facebook page. What grade would you give President Trump on his first 100 days in office? What do you think of his efforts around policy promises like immigration and health care and jobs? You can tell us your thoughts on his cabinet appointees, too. And if you chose to vote for Donald Trump, now President Trump, we want to hear what you think. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers. Harry is on the line in Burlington. Harry, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening, and I'm always unable to call because I'm listening from work, but I'd just like to say that I voted for Donald Trump not because I expected him to be able to do everything that he said he wanted to do, but I feel he's a man of integrity. He will at least attempt to keep his word. I don't agree with everything, but I get tired of listening to people rip on him when I think he's a leader. He'll stand up and do what he believes to be right because it's right, regardless of what other people say about him, and I'm proud of him.
And Harry, I wanted to ask, I've heard some Donald Trump supporters say, hey, look, he is trying to do the stuff he promised to do, and Congress, his allies in Congress and the Democrats are blocking some of the agenda. Do you point some of the blame that way?
Absolutely. People are playing the politics game, and I think he has the courage to do things on the world stage that have needed to be done for a long time, and our leaders have not done it because it'll affect their, you know, people voting for him or not. And I just give the man a lot of credit. He's got a tough job, and I think he's going to do a good job.
Harry, thanks a lot for the call. And Elizabeth, we hear this a lot in terms of people supporting Donald Trump. He's not like other politicians. He's going to say, do what he says he's going to do, and they appreciate that, win or lose.
No, you know, I completely agree with the caller. I think that, you know, he said he was going to do a lot of different things. I don't think people are saying, you know, he's a bad person, and look, he's been, you know, he's not doing his job, or he's lazy, or he's not a person of integrity. I think what he has done is he has said, you know, we're going to ban people from coming from these countries. We're going to build the wall. We're going to get very aggressive with North Korea. We're going to repeal and replace Obamacare and these sorts of things. Now, people have a lot of problems with him, for example, on environmental policy. you know, he's just saying he's going to be opening up all these areas for more drilling. He's, you know, he's going to get away from the clean power plan. You know, he doesn't believe in global warming. I think where people are opposed to Donald Trump is right there on the policy issues. And that's what politics is all about. As your caller said, you know, people play the politics game. They certainly do, because politics is nothing more than means to an end. It's only about having power to push through the policies you believe in. And that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to push through the policies he believes in. He's had a lot of pushback on the right in the Congress. And, of course, he's had pushback on the left, but that's what politics is all about, pushback, because people believe in public policies. And that's why a lot of people are opposed to him. And that's really the bottom line, public policy.
Harry, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Doug in Adams Friendship. Doug, hi.
Hi. I had 2 points. I'm going to try and make it quick. One, Donald Trump's a businessman, so he's used to being the boss. He's used to running the business. He's used to telling everybody else how it's going to be. And that doesn't work in the way our government's set up. Second thing is if you are a business-type person with a business mind your whole life, business and government typically are at odds with each other, especially when it has to do with involvement over regulation. So why would you take a person who's been at odds with the government and put them in charge of it? Anyways, those are my 2 points.
Doug, thanks for the call. And yeah, that's something people have talked about, Elizabeth. The mm-hmm. new skills in the private sector as the boss of a company translate into the give and take of presidential politics.
Well, I think it's very tough for him because, you know, he has been the head of the Trump Organization, which is basically a family business in real estate. And, you know, he's the big boss, and he's been able to tell people and what he says goes. And as I said before, the way our system, our constitutional system is set up, as your caller said, the president doesn't really have that much power. You know, he's certainly in a position to say, here are the things I'm for, and recommend to Congress. And as a matter of fact, the Constitution says he is required to make a recommendation to Congress about what policies he favors. But they write the laws, they debate it, and debate is what we're supposed to have. Everyone's supposed to have, you know, their say if they're from Wisconsin or Florida or Maine or Montana or wherever they're from. Our representatives are the ones who make the laws, and sometimes they do to the liking of the president, and sometimes they don't. And that's the way this is. I mean, we set up, the founders set up the system so that the Congress would be in charge. I mean, people may not like it that way, but that's our system, and so far we're sticking to it.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Elizabeth Sherman from American University, marking this weekend's milestone, 100 days of the Trump administration. Back to our callers. Sam is on the line in Appleton. Sam, hi.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for your time today. I'm wondering how you think that Trump is doing running the government like a business. He said that a lot through his campaign, and he really pushed the idea that he's a businessman. He's going to run the government as a business. How do you think he's doing with some of the jobs that need to be filled still, or is that normal? And how do you think he's doing with meetings?
Well, I think one of the issues about running a business is that you want to stay in the black, don't you? And I think that this this new tax plan is going to cost $4 trillion. Now the question is, if you're going to cut $4 trillion out of the federal budget, that's a big, gigantic expenditure, and that's going to be tax cuts, for the corporations and for the top 5%. The claim is that they're going to create jobs somewhere along the line down the road. But in the meantime, what are you going to cut then out of the budget? Are you going to cut the military budget? Are you going to cut Social Security? Are you going to cut Medicare, education? What is going to be cut? Because you certainly don't want to be running your government in the red. And I think Americans are concerned about that deficit and that debt. And I think they look at this tax plan and they have to say, this is not the way a businessman, would propose a budget.
Sam, thanks for that call. We'll stay in Appleton. Butch is on the line. Butch, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm 100% in support of Donald Trump. I voted for him. I agree with just about everything he's done so far. And as far as his new tax plan, I was a business owner for 42 years. And if I had a chance to cut my tax rate and increase my business because of it, I'd buy more equipment, I'd hire more employees. He's on the right track.
Butch, thanks for the call. And that's the hope, of course, of a major tax cut like this, Elizabeth, boosting the economy and referring back to the whole supply side idea.
Right.
We're hearing more of that lately, that ultimately it could help pay for itself.
I know, but the caller also has to recognize that, you know, to have a tax cut of that magnitude, that means that $4 trillion has to be cut out of also on the spending side. So we just have to come up with all the elements on the spending side and say, where will the spending be cut? And I think those line items have to be identified on the spending side. You know, the other thing that I would say is that more and more people are in low-income jobs. About 50% of Americans are either in low-income or very low-income jobs, or poor or elderly. And, you know, those might be the customers for your caller. I think they certainly are the customers who, you know, go into Macy's or go into CVS or wherever they're going to the grocery store. They're paying their rent or their mortgage. What we do see is that incomes are way down. As a matter of fact, incomes have not appreciably grown, if you can believe this, holding for inflation, since 1970. I think businesses thrive when businesses have customers. And I think the hard-pressed Americans in this country are the ones who really need to be thinking about good jobs at good wages. And the businesses have been doing very well. Profits are way, way, way up. The stock market is booming. But we're not seeing the investment. We're not seeing those. We're seeing the factories still closing. The jobs still going overseas. Automation is displacing people all over the country. And I think Donald Trump has to have a plan for that.
Butch, thanks a lot for the call. And Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely, Rob. I've enjoyed it.
We've been talking to Elizabeth Sherman, Assistant Professor of American Politics at American University's School of Public Affairs. She joined us to talk about Donald Trump's presidency so far as we come up on his 100th day in office. And still time for you to share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. First, it's easy to take bread for granted. It's a staple of the sandwiches and the toast we eat every day, but our next guest takes bread to the next level and sees it as one of the most versatile ingredients around. She's with us to give us inspiration for how to make and then use those leftover pieces of bread, day-old slices, and turn them into delicious meals.
Alexandra Stafford is with us now. She blogs about food at Alexandra's Kitchen, and she's the author of Bread, Toast, Crumbs, recipes for no-need loaves and meals to savor every slice. Alexandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it sounds like your love affair with bread, it really started with your mother's famous no-knead peasant bread. Why is this particular bread so special?
I think the reason it's so special is because it truly is so simple. It's just, I think people think you have to do so many things to make a good loaf of bread. You have to, you know, let it rise for a super long time. You have to knead it. You have to bake it in a Dutch oven. You have to turn your oven into a professional oven. And this recipe that she's been making for my whole life is just, it's just, you know, it's four or five ingredients, you know, flour, salt, sugar, water, yeast. It rises in about an hour. The second rise is about 20 minutes, and it rises in these buttered Pyrex bowls, and you bake it, and a half an hour later, you have just this the most delicious bread. So I really think the what's so special about it is its simplicity.
But what I understand about this bread, this no-knead bread, is that your mom had it on a need-to-know basis. She would not share this recipe with anyone.
Oh, she wouldn't share it with even her closest friends. She would direct them to the back of the King Arthur flour bag, and she just would say, yeah, just follow the recipe. And for years, I didn't even think about sharing it on my blog. It just was untouchable. And then, you know, as time went on, I thought, gosh, this would be really, really nice to share with people. And she finally acquiesced and let me share it. So,
and it became kind of a sensation, didn't it? I understand it's gotten at least a million hits. So this is something that people are really interested in. They want to make bread, but it sounds like they just don't want to have to spend an entire day doing it.
Right, exactly. It has been from people who feared bread making their entire lives. I mean, they have people write in all the time saying, I never had success making bread, and this is the recipe that that did it for me. But also experienced bakers write in and they say, you know, I'm astonished by the results because I'm, you know, I bake bread all the time, and for so long I've just been putting way more work into my loaves, and this is just as good. So it's, you know, for all sort of levels of bread bakers, it can fit into your, you know, into your, you know, repertoire.
This recipe, for our listeners, it is at Alexandra's Kitchen, our guest blog. You can find it there and try it out. One pro tip, Alexandra, that you share in the book, you have a lot of them, but is when you're measuring out the flour, weigh it, don't measure it in a cup. Why is that?
It's just mostly for consistency. So if you were to scoop out a cup of flour and we were to put it on a scale, it would weigh one thing. If I were to do the same thing, it would weigh another. And if you multiply that by four, the final amount of flour will be totally different. So if you just know every single time that it's going to be 512 grams, you know, and you can hold the flour bag in one hand and just dump it into the bowl, and it takes less time, but but foremost, it's will always be accurate.
And you've written this entire cookbook that revolves around bread, and it kind of starts with your mother's epic loaf of bread, but it moves on from there because you see bread as one of the most versatile ingredients that's around anywhere. Why do you think that bread is such a great ingredient?
Part of it is that because I'm baking bread all the time, I always have it on hand. So I'm kind of looking for creative ways to use it. But as I was doing research for the book, I learned that this is what people have been doing, you know, for centuries. They've been baking bread and they've been using it, and not just, you know, French toast and stuffing and sort of the classic things that we think about. They use it right down to the crumb. So, you know, they'll take heels of bread. And I mean, the sort of classic example are these Italian grandmothers who would revive stale heels of bread with milk and then mix it with whatever scraps of meat they had on hand, and they'd make delicious meatballs. And then it can be a thickener in soups to just give, you know, give it texture, or sauces. There are countless examples. I always have half a loaf on hand, and if I don't, I have a stash of crumbs in the freezer that I can, you know, crisp up and toss over pasta, or toss over vegetables. They just add a little, sautéed vegetables can get boring if it's just olive oil and garlic the whole time. And if you crisp up some breadcrumbs with some seasonings, you know, the dish transforms, and it's just such a simple way to do it.
Alexandra Stafford is with us now. She's the author of the new cookbook, Bread, Toast, Crumbs, Recipes for No-Knead Loaves, and Meals to Savor Every Slice. Let's get into some of those recipes now. We've got a few linked, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll have a pronunciation challenge for Rob here. Pasta di aere. Am I anywhere near with anchovies, tomatoes, and onions, if that helps narrow it down based on my pronunciation?
Yeah, I didn't take French, but I think it's pistola di aere. You pronounce the R, and it's just this classic French.
I was shooting for Italian. That's where I went wrong.
Oh, okay, yeah. So you see it if you've seen any breads that sort of look like focaccia with the anchovies arranged in kind of a crisscross pattern, and then there's usually like an olive in the center of the diamonds that are made by these crisscrossed anchovies. And I think some people, they think they don't like anchovies, so if they see them like that, they just, you know, they'll be instantly turned off. But if you puree the anchovies with the garlic and the capers and some olive oil, and you kind of make a paste and spread that over the dough, and then add tomatoes and caramelized onions, and it's just really delicious. It's that sweet. There's the caramelized onions, and then all the sweet from the capers and the anchovies and the olives. So there's that salty sweet dynamic, which is really nice. And that's a great thing to make. You can kind of make it, I mean, not super far in advance, but you make it, you just serve it at room temperature, just cut it into squares, and it's just a nice, a nice lunch or an appetizer.
How hard is that one to make?
Oh, I mean, they're all just, I mean, the dough recipe, the dough for the pisolettiere is the same as the master peasant bread recipe. So same exact process. You just, instead of baking it in those buttered Pyrex bowls, you spread it onto a 9x13, you know, rimmed baking sheet, add some more olive oil, let it rest for about, if you let it rest for 20 minutes, it's easy to stretch. And if it resists, you just let it rest for another 5 minutes, stretch it again. And that's it. Then you top it and bake it. It's just, it's as simple, with the exception of having to make the toppings. It's as simple as the master recipe.
And this is anchovies, tomatoes, and onions. I imagine you can play around with that a lot, what you're actually putting in that topping.
Oh, yes, definitely. There's another, a different variation in the book has grapes and pancetta. I've put creme fraiche and caramelized onions and thyme is delicious. You could make it cheesy. You could, any way you would top a pizza, you could top the pisolettiere.
And you have recipe for, I mean, what I would call really fancy toast, because toast is really having a moment right now. I'm seeing it. There are whole restaurants devoted to fancy toast, avocado toast, and it seems as though, you know, toast has been elevated, and you have a spin on that. You know, it's not quite bruschetta, but it is a bread. You've got your fava salad on it and herbed ricotta. Can you talk us through that particular recipe?
Sure. And that one was inspired by a lunch that my Aunt Marcy and I had together. And we were she's in Burlington, Vermont. And it was this, you know, it's always freezing there. Or most of the year it's freezing. And it was, you know, end of March. And we were just looking for something fresh. And Lake Champlain was still like icy and there was snow everywhere. And we went to this restaurant. And I think sadly it's closed now. But it was just the freshest. It was homemade ricotta, which they had seasoned with lemon zest and thyme. And then they topped it just with endive and fava beans and radishes. And it just, it was the first signs of spring. And it's one of my favorites to make this time of year when you just kind of, you can't quite get all the sort of spring gems that you love from the farmer's market. But, you know, some things are starting to show some life, and you could make any kind of salad and top it, but there's something nice about the bitter endive and the radishes, and then in combination with the creamy ricotta, it's nice.
Alexandra Stafford is with us right now. She blogs about food at Alexandra's Kitchen, and she's the author of the new cookbook, Bread, Toast, Crumbs, Recipe for No-Knead Loaves and Meals to Savor Every Slice.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a simple, no-fuss bread recipe in your family? What's your secret to the perfect bread for grilled cheese? Do you have your own special version of fancy gourmet toast, like avocado toast? Do you have questions for a guest about making bread or about using that bread in fun, exciting new ways, different kinds of recipes, or using that old stale bread for that matter? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page where you'll find some of our Food Friday recipes linked.
And we'll pick up our conversation with Alexandra Stafford in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And our guest, Alexandra Stafford, stays with us. She blogs about food at Alexandra's Kitchen and is the author of the book, Bread, Toast, Crumbs, Recipes for No-Knead Loaves and Meals to Savor Every Slice.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have simple bread recipes you like to make? Do you have a no-knead recipe? Or do you need some advice on how to do that? Have you been frustrated like me on more fanciful labor and intensive types of breads? Need some advice, something a little more your speed? And do you use bread in different recipes, maybe unexpected places? Do you save those old stale slices for soup, meatballs, you name it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find some recipes from our guest on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Carol joining us first in Nina. Carol, hi.
Hi. Hi. I am calling. I love to bake bread. I use a bread machine sometimes. I do it by hand. But I'm always struggling with what type of flour I should be using for the best quality bread. You know, there's so many different types of flours out there. And just looking for a little bit of guidance in that area.
Great question. And what do you think about that, Alexandra? Are you faithful to a particular brand of flour?
I am. I've always, and this is also because my mother has always used King Arthur flour. I have always used King Arthur flour. That's not to say I haven't tried other flours. And something I have been trying to do more recently is use some local flours. There's a flour company in the Finger Lakes called Farmer Ground Flour that I like because they stone mill the flour, so they keep the kernel intact when they grind it. I don't want to get too technical. They sift out some of the bran and the germ, so it has a little bit of a whole wheat kind of nature to it, but it's not as hard to work with as, you know, using a 100% whole wheat flour. So that's nice because it has a little more flavor. I think in terms of picking a flour, it really just depends on what your goal is. I mean, so I use King Arthur all-purpose flour all the time because it truly is, it's so reliable. It always works. And I'm not necessarily the best at getting my whole grains through my bread. I just, bread for me is just pure pleasure. I just love eating it. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's a vehicle for other toppings and spreads. But if you want to use it as a way to get whole grains, then there are lots of great whole wheat flours out there. And a new one from King Arthur Flour that I've discovered is their sprouted wheat flour. And so every so often I'll use half of the amount of flour. I'll substitute this sprouted wheat flour because it does give, I mean, it gives it some, just a little bit of a different flavor. The texture of the crumb is still light, but it does kind of feel a little bit better. You know, you feel like you feel a little bit more virtuous about the bread that you're eating. If you want like a rye bread, you just, you know, one cup of rye flour goes a long way. Where it gets tricky is, you know, if you want to do gluten free, that takes a little bit more experimenting, because every gluten free flour absorbs water in different ways, so it gets a little tricky. There's one gluten free recipe in the book, every so often I'll get a comment saying, "Oh, I substituted coconut flour and it just didn't work." And I mean, it's tricky. It gets tricky when you start making these substitutions with gluten-free flours.
Carol, thanks a lot for the call and happy baking. We'll go back to our callers now with Corey in New London. Corey, hi.
Hi. So pretty much for my like favorite grilled cheese, I use a honey walnut bread. And I put smoked Gouda cheese in it, but I've never made my own bread with that, so might have to try that out.
All right, smoked Gouda and honey walnut bread is his combo. Yeah, I imagine you've got some thoughts, Alexandra, on the issue of grilled cheese.
That sounds so good. Oh, yeah. I have to say that combination, Corey.
That sounds delicious. I have a few sort of tricks that I always employ when I make a grilled cheese, but I'm not necessarily, you know, it doesn't have to be a certain bread. It doesn't have to be a certain cheese. I love different combinations, but the tricks I use, and lots of people know this trick now, but is to use mayonnaise on the bread as opposed to butter, because mayonnaise, it browns much more evenly and it won't burn before the cheese melts. But I like to mix that mayonnaise with a little bit of salted butter, because then you don't lose the buttery flavor. So you still get the best of both worlds. You get the buttery flavor, and you also, your bread will brown nice and evenly. I always sort of smear the bread, so I never add oil or butter to the pan. It's just directly on the bread. I weigh down the first side with either like a bacon press or another heavy pan to just get it going. And then I don't weigh it down on the second side. I'm trying to think what else. I think that's about it.
You're already
but
way
I do
past
have,
me. Yeah.
Yeah. I have my method down. But I that honey walnut with Gouda sounds amazing.
I gotta agree about that. Corey, thanks a lot, and hope some of these ideas work. Mayonnaise on bread. Grilled cheese, which is one of my favorite meals, pretty much. So, do you taste the mayonnaise? Does it taste like that or no?
Amazingly, you don't. I think I did find when I first learned the trick, I was using exclusively mayonnaise, and then the more grilled cheeses I ate, I thought, gosh, I just think something's missing a little bit. I think it was just that buttery taste. But you really don't taste the mayonnaise at all. It's incredible.
Definitely one to try. We're talking with Alexandra Stafford right now. Blogs about food at Alexandra's Kitchen. And her new cookbook is called Bread, Toast, Crumbs. And let's go back to our callers now. We have Sue joining us in Baraboo. Sue, hi.
Hi. My question is pertaining to the way that flour has been processed in the most recent years leading up to today. Because I have heard from some people who are just terrific home bakers that flour has changed. And it produces more of a tasteless home product. So I was just wondering what your expert thinks on that.
I have heard this too, and this is part of the reason why I was saying I was trying to go back to sort of the trying to experiment more. Sorry, with the local flour and the stone milled flours, because a lot of people most flour in this country is milled by roller milling. So the kernel is separated into its three separate parts, and even whole wheat flour, it's separated and then it's put back together. And a lot of people believe that as soon as it's separated, the flavor is lost and the nutritional value is also lost. I still use all-purpose flour, and I love it because it's so easy to work with, and I don't find the taste to have been affected, too much. But I do think that there's something to be said about this stone milling, which keeps the kernel intact and probably is much more nutritious. And there definitely are some flavor. You can taste the wheat more. I'm trying to think. I think if you are concerned about that, that would be something to look for. Would be to look for a local flour, just because you'll know it will have been milled fresh for you, and look for the stone milling, because that does mean that it's the kernel has been kept intact through the milling. I don't know if that helps.
Sue, thanks a lot. Hope that does help. As we start to wrap up, Alexandra, one thing we love here at Central Time is dessert. How can we take some of our savory bread and turn it into a delicious dessert?
There's some classic examples like bread pudding, which is delicious, and Charlotte. That was a new thing that I discovered. I think it's a southern dessert, but you basically take slices of bread and you soak them in butter, and then you line a pan with your bread, and then you fill it with fruit and top it with sugar, and you bake it, and that's also delicious. But some of the more surprising ones for me were just the same way that you would. For a savory application where you toast up crumbs with olive oil and add garlic or lemon zest or however you want to season it, and you put it over pasta or vegetables, you can do that, but make it sweet. So you use butter and you saute the crumbs in butter, and you add a little bit of sugar, or you add some toasted coconut, or you add cocoa, and they are just these irresistible. I taught a class on like a bread toast crumbs baking class, and people were so surprised by how good the cocoa crumbs were on, a scoop of ice cream. So you really can do a lot. And another, classic genre is the Brown Betty, where it's very similar to like a blueberry crisp or a fruit crisp.
But, it all sounds delicious. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us. Lots of ideas for us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Alexandra Stafford. She blogs about food at Alexandra's Kitchen, and she's the author of Bread, Toast, Crumbs, recipes for no-need loaves and meals to savor every slice. And don't forget, you can find three of her recipes, utilizing, of course, bread, over on the Central Time Facebook page. So check those out. Might be a good rainy weekend to do some bread baking.
Wisconsin's population has gone up by two lions. The Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison just announced the arrival of two lion cubs.
The baby lions were born at the end of February. The zoo announced in a press release that the lions are likely to come out of their den in late May, and that's going to be the first chance for the public to see them in person.
Can't wait that long. We have a link to an article with pictures on the Central Time Facebook page. Cute kitties.
Oh, they're adorable. They're really small, yet in these pictures, as you might expect, they're still with their mama. But man, I am going to be first in line when those lion cubs are out.
Well,
they're adorable.
The plan is clear. We need lion cubs here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Right. And I think management would be on board. Right. I can't see a reason that they would stand in our way. It would be a Central Time mascot.
I have yet to think of a downside to having lion cubs.
We wanted lion
in
cubs,
studios.
And let's see, also this week we want a float tank for our office, so I think these are all improvements.
I forgot about that.
That we can do.
Right, definitely. Yeah, so we'll include that in our plans for the coming year. In the meantime, though, look at those lion cubs. We've got links to the pictures on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.